We're using this last week of the year to revisit some notable interviews of the past in our second hour. Today you'll hear our 2013 interview with Dr. William Meisel about his book, The Software Society. Since it is pre-recorded, we're unable to take any new phone calls or emails today. There are still holdouts among us, but the vast majority of Americans got used to having computers around years ago. And it's not like they're just hanging around. We use them and use them for a great many things. 15 years ago, would you have laughed if somebody talked about watching a movie on the telephone? Now it's not only taken for granted, it's a touted feature of the newer cell phones. We'll spend this hour talking about the vast changes in society brought about by computers and our reliance upon them. Dr. William Meisel wrote The Software Society, Cultural and Economic Impact. And William Meisel worked in academia and the business world in his career, holds a bachelor's in engineering from Caltech and a Ph.D. in electrical engineering from USC. His research in recent years has focused on speech recognition technology, and he now works as a technology industry analyst. Bill Meisel, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff.
It's good to have you here. When you got your Ph.D., did you really think we'd be sending text messages by talking into our phones?
Well, I have to admit, I was... always one of these people who believed in the future of technology. I even got involved in writing technical books on how computers could do pattern recognition. And I was a science fiction fan, so I guess in some ways I did believe in that.
But watching movies on your phone, did you get there?
I guess that wasn't one I thought of, no.
Right. Overall, Bill, is the world of technology about where you thought it would be when you started teaching?
I guess I'm not surprised. The acceleration of that technology has caught almost everybody by surprise, though. I mean, Apple, of course, gets credit for inventing the idea of the smartphone with the iPhone, and the huge impact that's had and how fast it happened is kind of a symptom of what's happening with technology now, with software driving everything. You know, and it used to be that... you want to change hardware, you have to change some gears and pulleys, and when things are driven by software and digital devices, you can upgrade them by just a little download over the internet. So not only do the devices get updated more often, even the ones you have get change their behavior because of software upgrades. So the rate of change in technology because of so many things being driven by digital technology is just been incredible.
When you put it in that context, the hardware versus software part, it really does kind of come true. You can see where this goes because, for example, if you ever wanted to change the ringtone on the phone you got from AT&T many years ago, you had to get a different phone.
Right.
And now you just push a couple of buttons on your deck of card-sized cell phone and you get a different ringtone. You do have a blog and a newsletter that you put out on a regular basis, and you point out that they could not contain what you had to say. So what was it that that prompted you to write a whole book about the software society?
Well, I guess in part I didn't think people realized the degree to which our technology impacts our society and our culture. Part of technology has always made it part of been part of what it is to be human, and going all the way back to when farming machinery and transportation like railroads made it possible for people to move to cities, and city life is much different than farm life. There was a time when you pretty much had to live on a farm because it was you had to be near the source of food and had to produce that food with a lot of people. So I mean, that goes way back, but then you get into all kinds of technology advances, like automobiles made possible supermarkets for simple reasons like, well, now you have a trunk you can put three bags of groceries in. If you were walking, you wouldn't do that. I mean, some things we don't even think about that really have changed our lives.
And you point out that software expansion has gotten to the point where it really is impacting the evolution of human society. We're not talking about the evolution of people as a species. We're talking about the evolution of society, right?
That's right. And well, in some sense, where does the boundary between people and technology? I mean, very few of us would walk out of our house without wearing clothes, but in some sense, technology makes clothes possible. So, where's the boundary? And I think with this technology, with language technology like speech recognition and Apple Siri, we're going to see that almost become something that's indisposable. Right now, if people lose their cell phone, they kind of panic because that's where all their phone numbers are stored and so forth. So cell phones kind of become part of your memory. I don't know if you know, I guess you don't have to be old to remember the days when you actually memorized phone numbers.
Right.
And that, you know, that as that language connection gets better, then that technology becomes maybe not part of you, but certainly your friend. Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, actually made a statement like that recently. He said, "We're getting to the point where we're not going to talk to our computer like it was a dog, but talk to, but it will become our friend." To use that word, so I think that. That technology is getting very close to us.
Talk to the computer like a dog. I see the point of, like, you know, I will want to find out. Yeah, you talk to it like very carefully.
Bark or something.
Go get your bone. It's not quite to that point yet. We'll come back and talk more about the barking computer dogs and other flights of fancy with Dr. William Meisel. He's the author of The Software Society. This is an interview from 2013, so no phone calls and emails. You'll hear more of this interview when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. On the Jefferson Exchange, on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening on this fourth day of Christmas, and Merry Christmas to you. We want to remind you that we are dealing with an interview from a couple of years ago. Dr. William Meisel joined us in 2013 to talk about his book, The Software Society, about the interdependence of people and computers and where he sees that going and where he thinks it's already gone. Again, since this is pre-recorded, we can't take any new phone calls or emails today. Just to get a look at the landscape for how things work with software, Bill, recent changes with mobile devices and cloud computing are well documented in the book. I have to wonder if software people have a hard time keeping up.
Well, yeah. I mean, and then you get the demands are kind of impressive on technical people. I just came back from a conference in New York called Speech Tech, where there were a lot of people trying to help solve this problem of talking to computers, and they're being pressed hard to have computers not only be able to take speech and transcribe it, like if you're dictating an email, but also to understand it and then act on it, or provide answers to questions. You know, so there's all kinds of technology demands, and the people involved in trying to provide that core technology are working hard to try to keep up with what people expect.
When you began to work in speech recognition yourself, did you expect that it would be just transcription, or did you think there'd be more to it even then?
I did think so. But you know, having actually tried to build this stuff, I ran a speech recognition company for 10 years. I know how hard it is.
The pattern recognition stuff and speech recognition as well. Give us an example, because you cite it in the book about IBM's work on identifying babies' cries.
Yeah, the IBM, I think the technology that is best known to the general public from IBM is what they call Watson technology, and that was the one that actually competed on the Jeopardy TV show and beat a couple of champions. And what their Watson technology does is it takes a whole bunch of data and translates it into information that you can use. For example, one of the first things they did was take huge databases of information and studies on drugs and allow doctors to, for example, know whether one drug would interact with another and cite the sources for those conclusions. They've now commercialized it and made it into something where when you call in a call center, the call center agent can answer your question by essentially getting IBM software to tell what the company's whole range of resources, from web pages to frequently asked questions to corporate policies and so forth, try to give them a succinct answer to a difficult question by analyzing all that so-called big data. I think the term big data is something that's another one of those technical terms that's become popular. But it is a very advanced technology.
Bill, do computers recognize patterns the same way people do, or do they have their own specific way, and are the differences being narrowed over time? Are computers getting more like human brains?
They really aren't. What they do is learn from people. So the term Microsoft, for example, uses the term machine learning, which I think is a better way of thinking of it. Some people use the term artificial intelligence, which makes it sound like it's trying to mimic the way people think. And I think that's a misunderstanding, because it's basically, for example, in speech recognition, the reason it's gotten so good is that we've been able to use more and more computer memory and get more and more examples of speech and then beat it to death find out the statistical parameters that help tell one word from another. It isn't that it understands; it's more that it's learning from people by example. So, I mean, maybe that sounds like, when I say learning, maybe that sounds like intelligence. But what I'm really saying is, the computer really is not understanding anything. It's just mapping from examples of data to what the outcome is in a statistical format.
Suggesting as his answer the one that was the most recent answer in the past, or the most frequent answer.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way Google search works, of course. If they give you a list of web pages and more people, when you put in those specific search terms, click on one than more than the other, it'll move up in the rankings. So, you know, it's basically using us as crowd as a source of information on what the right answer is. But the computer's not understanding anything more than more people like this answer than the other one.
We can take a call. Here's Ray in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Bill Meisel. His book is The Software Society.
Good morning. I just had a comment I wanted to make, and you kind of mentioned it in your closing for your last commercial break, but or announcement, but you were saying that it's not all good. And I'm not a huge fan of cell phones. They have a place, you know, to be used, and I see a lot of disconnect between people, especially families, and it's actually borders on actually disgusting. I saw a mother with a six-year-old child in a McDonald's here a few minutes ago, and I've got hundreds of these stories, but, I mean, the child is all excited talking to the mom, and the mom's just going, and scrolling down her cell phone. I mean, if she had a video of that and was played back to her, I think she would be appalled at what she was doing. And we see families out at dinner, you know, and they're all four of them are on their cell phones, and we don't allow them at the dinner table or when we play games and things like that. And it just seems like it's really a sad time when you have one more thing that's driving a wedge between people actually communicating face-to-face.
All right. Thanks for the call, Ray. Appreciate that. Bill, you don't really go into so much that part of the disconnect in the book, but how do you feel about that sort of thing that Ray's talking about when you see it?
Well, I have the same reaction. And, you know, I just came from a conference where people are giving talks, and there's people in the audience sitting there working on their cell phones instead of listening to the talk. So, there is definitely a component there where people misuse this technology. But I think also it's a little bit misleading, because I've heard that there's even been some books written about the importance of face-to-face contact and how we're losing that. But the fact of the matter is, that person, even though the mother was ignoring the kid, and that's certainly not an acceptable solution, she was actually probably communicating with other people. And so this technology does allow you to communicate with more people more easily and keep more connections with people, if you want to look at it that way. I think a good example of that is that my niece, who lives half a country away, has a couple of young girls that are charming, and every week she sends out pictures of them and a little description of what they're doing this week. And I see them growing up. It's a completely different experience than the once a year I might get back to Houston and see them. This is a mixed bag, and I think, you know, obviously any technology can be abused. But I personally think, to be honest, that it's actually allowing more connections. I think, you know, email's a pretty efficient way to stay in contact with a lot of people, that if you were making a phone call or having to travel to visit them each time you wanted to have that conversation, it would be impossible.
And you don't have to look for a stamp either.
Yeah, right.
Bill Meisel's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Software Society, Cultural and Economic Impact. We haven't even talked about the economic part yet. There's a lot there. This interview on the Exchange is pre-recorded, so the usual give and take is not present. We're not giving the phone number and the email address because we can't take any new phone calls or emails today. Bill, is there a level of discomfort with what computers do for us? I mean, are some of us still reluctant to accept the help that computers are able to give us?
Yeah, I think there definitely is. I that's when in my book I kind of one of the things that causes that, I think, is this sort of posture that we're trying to make computers take over the world, kind of this, there's been books that talk about the so-called singularity, when computers get more intelligent than humans and humans are kind of useless, and even a book called The End of Work that says, well, when there's no more jobs, we'll all have to figure out how to spend our time, and even suggested that we, you know, pay people by how many books they read. Gets to some pretty ridiculous stuff. And I think part of that is using terms like artificial intelligence, which drives me crazy because there's nothing really intelligent about a statistical analysis. That's why I like the term machine learning, which is one that Microsoft uses all the way down. Steve Ballmer, actually, in the letter, his last letter to shareholders, listing three or four focus areas, one of them was machine learning, and they use that terminology, which I think is a little more accurate in terms of what's going on. But that, and the science fiction, of course, pictures of all the way back to HAL in 2001 that takes over the spaceship and kills all the astronauts except one. You know, that those kinds of things create the kind of expectation that there's a competition going on, and I don't think that's the case at all.
So you like science fiction, but not the rise of the machines or things like that?
Yeah, exactly. There's science fiction, of course, goes much too far in terms of what can actually be done, in a long time from now.
But as you write in The Software Society, it looks like the companies that are smart about people and their computers are at least cognizant and careful about the concerns that people do have about the science fiction and the rise of the machines and all that stuff. Because you point that in the book that Google, for example, did not really give a personality to its personal assistant. Explain that, please.
Yeah, actually, I think that might be a mistake, and maybe it's changing a bit now. In the new Moto X phone, which is Motorola is now part of Google, you say, okay, Google, now tell me the nearest restaurant. So that gets pretty close to Siri. So they're getting a little closer now, but they have blogged that they don't believe that personal assistants are something new. They think it's just an extension of search. And in fact, that's really why there's so much competition between Apple and Google, because Apple does have the potential for making Siri an ad-based system. In fact, I think they do get paid now for directing people to specific websites. For example, if you ask for a reservation from Siri, she'll direct you to OpenTable and let you make the reservation. And I think that Apple gets paid for that. I know that some vendors of personal assistants do that. In fact, this is such an important area in terms of the future of interacting with these personal devices that Samsung in its Galaxy phones, which I guess are the best-selling phones right now, even over iPhone, at least Android phones are selling more phones than iPhones, and Samsung's Galaxy line is the best-selling Android phone. That has its own personal assistant. It does not use Google's technology. It uses technology with a company called Nuance Communications, which is actually the speech recognition technology in Siri. And why would Samsung want its own personal assistant when it can get free speech recognition from Google? Because they don't want to turn over the user to Google. If you remember the old days when there was an IBM PC and IBM said, well, gee, we need an operating system for this. Why don't we just ask this little company called Microsoft to write the operating system? Microsoft then became the definition of what PCs were instead of IBM. And IBM isn't even in the PC business anymore. So that lesson, I think, is translated to people like Samsung that want more connection with the customer. It's pretty important from the point of view of the evolution of where we're going with all these digital devices.
Funny you mentioned Nuance. I just realized that that's the voice recognition software in my phone, too. I'm aware of that being out there. You bring up some other concepts, though, where the proliferation of devices certainly causes some issues, if not outright problems. And BYOD, is that bring your own device?
Yeah, I mean, at work, that really is an issue for a lot of companies where people want to use their own device. And then, of course, and in fact, that's really something when you get into this cyber hacking kind of thing. The way the hackers usually get into a company is not through the back door, through the servers, where the company has all kinds of software trying to protect them, but it's usually some sort of social engineering where they get some employee to download something to their PC or their cell phone, and then the employee then connects that to a laptop or whatever to the company network, and suddenly the hackers inside the company network, you know, that becomes a huge issue for how companies control that. I think it's almost uncontrollable.
And there is a chapter in the book also on security and privacy, just on a personal level, which raises, as has been done a fair amount lately, is that are we less troubled by things like the NSA keeping tabs on phone calls and email messages because of the fact that we put so much stuff out in the world already ourselves through things like Twitter and Facebook?
Yeah, I think, and also, you know, in a sense, Google is able to give you ads it thinks is relevant to you by looking at what web page you're on. So, I mean, and they're keeping databases of where people go for web pages people go to. And in some sense, you're probably either going to have to give up some of your privacy for these free services or pay for the services, because something has to pay for all this effort and all the computing power that's going into this. So I think that's a interesting aspect of society, of whether and how much you're willing to give up for other goals.
Yeah, that's a big one for sure. And I must admit, I love to clear out the cookies every so often in my browser and just watch the ads change.
Right.
It's a good time. You have a section in the book on software and education. In your opinion, is the education business just keeping up with the computer world?
My argument in the book, and I focused on early education, because if you don't get kids off to a good start, they statistics show and common sense shows that they have a hard time catching up. One of the kindergarten teachers I interviewed said, you know, kids come to class for the first time and some of them barely speak English and other ones are reading at a third grade level. How do teachers manage that diversity? And I argued that technology can help, because if you have, say, something like a tablet computer with software on it, each kid can go at his own level and the teacher can be monitoring that and help the ones that need help. And challenge the ones that would otherwise be bored, which could be as much of a problem as the ones that are having trouble learning. So, you know, the nice thing is the Los Angeles Unified School District just bought 30,000 iPads for students. So apparently that message is been not just from me, obviously, but is being realized by the academic community.
Do you have a particular opinion, Bill, on where education should be taking place? Should it still be in the classroom, or online schools a better thing, do you think?
Well, it depends. You know, in South Korea, there was a recent article in the Wall Street Journal about the teacher who makes $4 million a year. because of these parents all pay for this education. The kids come home from school and then they go to the internet and study some more through these online services. Question is, you know, do we want kids to have time to play, or do we want to focus entirely on their education? It's a tough one.
A lot of tough issues to be considered here in this discussion with William Meisel from August of 2013 here on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the author of a book called The Software Society, Cultural and Economic Impact. You'll hear more of this interview when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're revisiting an interview from August of 2013 with William Meisel, the author of a book called The Software Society. He's a internet and technology expert and analyst, and has written several books, including a new novel, it turns out, called Technically Dead, a police procedural about involving computers. No surprise there. The Software Society is the book on the table today. We're talking to him about, or did talk to him about, in August of 2013. Since this is pre-recorded, we can't take any new phone calls or emails today. There's been a concern, evidently, about computers in the economy that far predates mass use of computers, and certainly this book. And you point out in the book that even LBJ, when he was in the White House, got a report on this.
Yeah, the I think the key thing is that, you know, in historically, there's been something that a well-known economist, Peter Schumpeter, talked about it called creative destruction, where technology comes along and suddenly some certain jobs become obsolete. You know, you don't drive a, if you drove a horse and buggy, you know, you now have to learn how to drive a taxi, I guess. So, you know, and somebody wrote a book that said, don't build buggy whips. The creative destruction historically, at least the economists argue, is good because it helps us, you know, get the people select what are good technologies, what they want, and then we move on. But when things change so quickly, it's not like the old time where you could learn how to drive a car and drive a cab. You know, the people can't go back to school and learn a new thing every year. So as technology drives the speed with which things change, it becomes a real issue, and jobs are being lost now because they're being automated away, and people are not able to readjust to that technology by somehow becoming engineers or wherever the job shortages are. You can't just decide, okay, I used to work on a production line, now I'm going to go get a degree in engineering because that's, or computer science, because that's where all the job openings are. You know, and not everybody is equipped to become a computer programmer. So I think it's a I've called it over automation in the book, that we're actually not, this is not something where I'm saying this is happening in the past. This is something where I'm saying it's happening right now. The middle class is shrinking, and the income of the middle class is shrinking. This is all available in the statistics, and in the last report from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the U.S. Government agency, it said that the decline in quarterly average wages in the last quarter was larger than they'd ever seen in the 47 years they've been reporting the numbers. So what's happening, it's one of these things like the mortgage crisis. After the fact, we see how stupid some of the actions were. You know, if you give loans to people who can't pay them back, somehow it's going to backfire eventually. Seems pretty obvious, but it certainly wasn't obvious at the time. What's happening right now is it seems that if there are no jobs, there's nobody to buy anything, then where does the revenues come from? What are the jobs for? You know, if we keep moving in this direction, which we are moving now, the statistics show it, if we keep moving in this direction, we're heading for disaster. And while people are now pointing out the problem, people are now saying, oh, gee, we're adding jobs, but it turns out the people taking those jobs, or like early starting jobs working in coffee shops and stuff, are well qualified in the past to have had other jobs. They're taking jobs at lower salaries, or they're part-time jobs where they're making less money because they're working less hours. You know, ultimately, if people don't have disposable income, we're in trouble.
So that erodes the middle class, because the people who were middle class are taking lower-paying jobs, and puts further pressure on people who are generally in less educated circumstances, and they get bumped down, bumped out, whatever. And so in the case of the recession that we're just emerging from now, you think it's longer and the recovery slower because of the fact that we just have automated away a lot of jobs?
Yeah, and of course the Fed is stuck with this problem of that they've been, not only you don't have to print money anymore, you just change an entry in the computer. One of the things I say in my book is the financial industry's really a software industry. If they raise rates, we see every time they talk about raising rates, stocks fall and people lose money on fixed rate bonds and so forth. They're stuck. And, you know, what eventually they have to, they can't keep doing this. They know it, and every economist knows it. But it's one of those things that there's no easy solution to. I mean, even if they say we have to eventually stop doing this, the stock market drops. So, we're in a tough situation. I think that the thing, we do have some time to solve the problem if we recognize the problem. I've suggested some solutions in my book that I won't go into in detail here, but we have to recognize what the problem is. And while we're seeing the symptoms and people are talking about the symptoms, I haven't seen people talking about over-automation and how we might address that problem. How do we create jobs? How do we encourage people to hire companies to hire people instead of hiring computers? That's the core thing. Right now, if you're a manager of a company, people are a nuisance. You have to give them health insurance. You have to pay a payroll tax. And, computers don't complain. And every year their salaries get lower.
Right, right.
So, if I were a manager running a company, I had the option of automating away a job or giving people a better tool to get more efficiency, I'd probably choose get automating the job because of the government promotes it, and the low interest rate business makes it cheap to take out a loan to buy capital equipment and build automated systems. I mean, so the government, in some sense, is promoting and making it easier to hire computers than people.
Let us take some calls. Mike and Eugene, welcome to The Exchange with Bill Meisel. His book is The Software Society.
Yeah, I mean, I just to add to the discussion here, I mean, the points we're talking about are kind of exactly what I'm talking about. But I think what we're suffering from is opportunistic determinism. I mean, there's like technological determinism, but as long as there's an opportunity for machines to do things quicker, better, more efficiently, we can't help it, and we're going to extinguish living things on Earth, because machines do everything better. I mean, the planet is becoming a machine, from genetics to production of everything, and to even thinking and memory, and we're basically making ourselves obsolete because we have the opportunity to do it, and the opportunity itself has a mind of its own. I mean, if I don't do it, somebody else will. So we're stuck on this cycle of whoever can do things fastest with the best results, which machines seem to do better than humans. Like you said, machines don't complain. Machines don't need health care. Machines can work 24/7. They don't have to be ever turned off at all. So, they need electricity, but not food. Mm-hmm. But I just feel like we're extinguishing conscious life and transferring it over to a machine because machines do it better.
All right. Thanks for that call. I very much appreciate that. Bill, is that where you're coming from? I mean, are you making the claim that the machines are quicker, better, and more efficient?
I think a part of the solution to the problem is to recognize that any tool can be misused. You take a hammer. Obviously, it's a tool that's very useful for for putting things together, it also can be used as a weapon. How do we handle that as a society? We create laws that discourage killing other people and punish people who do it. So the government has to intercede here in some way. So as a society, we have to make it more desirable to hire people and less desirable to do this automation. And we can do that. I mean, one of the ways of doing it that I suggest in my book is the tax system. Give a tax incentive to companies that produce a given amount of revenue, $1 million of revenue, with more people rather than less people. And the ones that produce a lot of money with no people should be taxed more heavily, because they need to support the social system that supports a social safety network. So, you know, anytime you talk about taxes, it gets very controversial, of course. But then, do we say, okay, I don't hear anybody saying, don't bother to punish murderers. I mean, you know, if technology is being misused, we need to give the government needs to give incentives to move it in the other direction.
Let us take another call. Here's Michael in Mendocino. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Bill Meisel, author of The Software Society.
Well, good morning, gentlemen. Allow me to plug two books that lend themselves very directly to the conversation. One, and I keep bringing these books up all the time in the hopes that somebody out there in radio land will actually read them. Paper Economy, written by David Bazelon 50 years ago, which addresses the fact that technology is changing so quick that it has literally made scarcity obsolete. Things like balance sheets, bottom ends, bottom lines, bottom this, bottom that, wages and so on and so forth, they're products of a bygone civilization. We don't need them. We produce so much stuff, and this, science is showing us daily, it's becoming cheaper and cheaper to make these products. The other book is Return from the Stars by Stanislaw Lem, a Czechoslovakian science fiction writer, who pointed out that it would be easier for a 20th century man. I'm sorry, let me go over that. It'd be easier for a Neanderthal to assimilate the 20th century than a 20th century person could assimilate the 21st, because technology would be growing so quick. So I think the biggest problem is getting everybody convinced that they can change their scarcity view of mankind. There's a world of plenty. But unfortunately, it's being harbored away by the powers that be to keep up this ridiculous pricing system, with the end result with this death-dealing capitalism. We'll be starving to death in front of our beautiful supermarkets because there's no food on the shelves, because inventory will kill you. At any rate, please consider reading these two books, everybody out there in Radio Land. And, of course, I'll take my answers off the air.
All right. Thanks for the call, Michael. Appreciate it. Thoughts, Bill Meisel?
Well, I'm a science fiction fan, too, and I like the Return from the Stars myself. Mm-hmm. I wasn't aware of the other book. There's another book more recent out that talks about this same issue by a couple of MIT professors who perhaps have more credibility in economics than I do, called Race Against the Machine. Unfortunately, they talk about the problem, but they don't come up with much of a solution. So the problem is a difficult one, and I think the issue, I mean, I'm kind of optimistic, but I think I just hope that it doesn't take a real crisis for us to look at this problem. I'd like us to look at this problem before we get to trouble. I think we have time in this country, and I think America has to lead the world back from an economic stagnation. We have time in this country because of a few indirect factors, like a discovery of shale oil and gas that are going to give us some lower energy prices, the fact that, in a sort of ironic way, fully automated factories are being built that compete with the Chinese low wages, and and China has to deal with a lot of pollution issues that are going to be very costly. I think we have time to solve this problem, but I just hope that we start to try to solve it before, instead of waiting until we have to recover from a double-dip recession.
You seem to not think much of Jeremy Rifkin's book about the end of work. I mean, he's not the first person to come up with this concept. John Kenneth Galbraith talked about it 75 years ago or so. The idea that as machines get better at doing things, people will have to spend less time at work. Do you entertain any notion of that happening?
Well, I mean, that's the only solution to that. Approach is a totally socialist solution. You basically, who has the money, if that's the case? If nobody gets a salary, who has the money? It's the corporation. So now you've got to tax the corporations and somehow pass that back to the people. What I didn't like about Rifkin's book was, you know, I think he's the one that suggested that he was struggling trying to figure out how we don't just come into a society of sloths or drug addicts if nobody's working. And, you know, that was one where he proposed paying people to read books. I mean, you know, you know, the whole idea is not very attractive to me. Of course, I guess I believe that a lot of what people are that is attractive is because they're thinking and struggling to find something they enjoy and do something productive and do something creative. And you know, if you had no incentive to do anything, I'm not sure what humanity would be.
Well, a lot to think about there, and the book is certainly worth a read. The Software Society, Cultural and Economic Impact. Bill Meisel, its author, our guest. Bill, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeff.
Bill Meisel joined us in August of 2013 to talk about that book. He's got other books out there as well, including, as I mentioned, a book called Technically Dead, a police procedural novel involving computers as well. Bill Meisel, again, from 2013.